Welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head-on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, facilitating cross-functional collaboration like a boss, iterating strategically, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, user experience designer and chief evangelist for Object-Oriented UX. I've taught OUX to companies big and small and to thousands of individual designers like you, and I am honored to be your host. What's up, OUXers? Today we have got the one, the only, the Joe Natoli. I just realized that rhymes.
That was really nice.
Yeah, that was. That just came out. So Joe Natoli, he has taught over 280,000 students on Udemy and within his UX 365 Academy. A very generous suite of online courses that, and I agree with this, I've taken many of those online courses, that Joe dubs as no bullshit
Amen.
UX courses. So cutting out the crap, getting to the heart of it. And he's also a successful UX consultant with over 30 years of experience. Is that right?
Yes, the grays say that that's correct.
Yes. I mean, this, you started doing this in the 90s, right?
Yeah. Yeah, which is insane to say that out loud, okay? Because I have no sense of time, but it really is. I'm fortunate.
I got one of those, you know how our photo apps are like, on this day, X number of years ago.
Yeah.
I got one yesterday that was like, on this day, 17 years ago. I was like, 17? It was 2006. I was like, 2006 was 17 years ago? Is that
right? Which
right?
Feels like, yeah, it feels like yesterday.
Yeah, 2006, like, I don't know. Anyways. So let's go. Like, what are we doing here? Let's go back. So backing up to why we are friends and why we're hanging out. Mm-hmm. So it was 2 years ago, again, crazy time, like beginning of pandemic when everybody was like, how are we going to do things where we talk to each other? And Clubhouse became a big thing. I don't know. Is Clubhouse, are people still in Clubhouse? Is Clubhouse still a...
I don't know. I'm not. I think about heading back every once in a while to check it out. The last time I did it was a couple of months back, and I had to weed through a lot of stuff, let's say.
Okay. Yeah, I have not been back in since we did that thing. So we basically were on a panel together talking about UX design, mm-hmm. and I said something. I don't know. I was talking about object-oriented UX, of course, and you just lit up. Do you remember what it was and that was like original conversation that you were like, this is cool. We should talk more.
I don't remember the exact comment, but what I absolutely completely do remember is that everything you were saying, right, and the way you were saying it and the way you were describing it, my no bullshit meter went off. Okay. When it was like, this is real. This is down to earth. There's no, I can't think of the word, sort of fantasy land, perfect world, detailed, just follow these steps and everything will be right with the world. Everything you were talking about to me was incredibly practical, incredibly useful, and just cut through the bullshit. Like, okay, you're not going to have enough time to do what you need to do. You're surrounded by a whole lot of stuff that you could be doing, but that doesn't really move the needle in any meaningful way. And the more I listened to you talk about OOUX, just all my bells were going off. Like, this makes all the sense in the world. And quite frankly, I thought, okay, I want to learn more about this, number one. And number two, it's a person I want to talk to more, which is kind of how I roll. You know, when something lights me up, as you said, I'm like, I'm kind of all in. Like, yeah, okay. Because there's a lot of bullshit out there. There really is.
And one of the coolest things is when somebody that you are a fan of becomes a fan of you. So we get to be mutual fans of each other. Because I had, like, I'd taken your information architecture course. I'd taken another one of your courses.
Yeah.
Just to kind of brush up because I hadn't, you know, I think I was, that was around probably like 2018 or something that I dove into your courses. And I was like, okay, like just he's just telling it how it is. It's just getting right into it and not wasting my time.
Yeah.
So we got on a call after that Clubhouse panel. I think you reached out to me, or I think we like reached out to each other. We were both like, hey, like, we should talk more.
Yeah, there was a mutual follow-up. I remember.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we got on a call, stayed on that call for way longer than what the time was allowed for, what we allotted. And we're just basically like just working each other up into a lather. Just yeah. Like,
you're awesome. No, you're awesome. No, you're awesomer.
You're right. No, you're even more right.
Yeah, there was a lot of that.
There was definitely a lot of that. So on that call, we decided like, hey, you do courses, I do courses, let's do a course together. So we decided to do this course together. That this was 2 years ago, and then so much has happened. We kind of, there was false starts and then restructuring the course and then finally filming the course, and now we're editing it and we are on the brink. We are on the brink of releasing this course. We are recording this mid-February 2023, and this course is coming out
Spring
2023. This course
the promised land is in sight. I can see it.
It is so in sight. And so what's actually happening on this podcast right now is we've got, in full transparency to everybody that's listening, we've got two more modules that we were wanting to film. One about sketching, UX sketching, and like what's going on with sketching and what are some thoughts on sketching. And then also on that just kind of feeds right into the pushback that you might get. If you're really excited about OUX and you want to bring it into your company and introduce it to your team, what kind of pushback might you expect? So those are two topics that we're definitely going to get on. We probably will get on other things. And those will likely, this is the plan, and you know how plans are. This is the plan, is that those two snippets of this larger conversation of the podcast are actually going to turn into those last two modules. So there's many reasons why I am really excited about this course coming out. Joe, what are you excited about?
Same. Well, I'm excited for the reason I always get excited about things, which kind of leads back to the conversation we just had. Okay. You know me well enough to know that I feel like there's a lot of useless fluff out there, to be frank, around this industry, around this profession, around the day-to-day jobs that people do. And I'm confronted every week with young people in particular, or people who are sort of new to this profession, who are essentially coming to me because they're running into walls. They've walked into this job and they've done it with this set of expectations and assumptions about how this work happens, right? And how I'm going to interact with other people, and how I'm going to work with teams, and how I'm going to work with developers and product owners and product managers, et cetera, et cetera. And they wind up sort of within the first couple of weeks running headfirst into wall after wall after wall, and they don't really understand why it's happening. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that happens is they start looking at themselves and saying, oh, well, it must be me, right? The problem must be me. I'm not good at this. I should have never taken this job. I don't know what I'm doing, et cetera, et cetera. And when you break that down and you talk to them and you hear the stories about what they're doing and how they're doing it, and you start to get a sense of why it isn't working, it all becomes very clear. And part of the problem, the biggest part of the problem, in my opinion, is that they don't have a set of practical methods and processes that they can fall back on. And even if they do, in some cases, those methods aren't flexible enough and aren't fast enough, quite frankly, in a corporate setting where everybody wants everything yesterday, to get them where they need to be and sort of get everybody else riding the same train as well. So the reason I'm excited about this course is I've told you this the very first time we talked. OOUX to me accomplishes all that. There is so much about this framework that brings everybody to a common level of understanding very fast. Because of what it is, what are we talking about? Objects. Okay, I get it. You know, if you're talking to developers, if you're talking to programmers, object oriented, get it with you, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You've automatically, from word go, got a common narrative that everybody understands, and everybody kind of starts off on the same footing, so to speak. And I think you get to clarity very quickly. And that does not happen with sort of the traditional, very heavy
double diamond type process where we have to have a ton of research and we have to ton of exploration and we have to do a ton of wireframing, right? And a ton of testing and everything else. So long-winded answer, but that's what I love about all this.
Well, it's those that kind of like misalignment of expectations and reality that happens with our industry and with folks that maybe have gone through a boot camp or like even like an HCI degree or something like that. Yeah. And they come in, and this happened even from being background of industrial design and entering in the field and having these expectations on what the kind of problem solving that I would get to do in UX and in a role like this and how much fun it was going to be. Like I had this like really strong expectation of like, this is going to be super fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
And like all the, like this kind of, this idea on all the stuff that I'm going to get to do and really digging into user research and getting to like, you know, that I was picturing like this ethnographic research, like, right. Like going and like being able to like look over the shoulder of the users and like, you know, being a fly on the wall and taking my notes and everything and getting, you know, weeks to do this, not months, but like I was, or like at least days I was expecting.
You would think
that I would be able to do that. And then like all of the, I had this idea in my head on what it was going to be. And then you go in and so much is stripped down.
Yes.
And you don't have that kind of time. And it's like, where is the middle, right? Because a lot of what UX or OUX is trying to do is shove some of that back into the process, right?
Yes.
We'll probably get into talking about Agile.
It's the right way to phrase it. Absolutely the right way to phrase it.
Yeah, it's like we have this Agile, we have this business environment. We've got, we're right now, we have this iterative lean, which often is just means like, you don't have any time, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
It's lean.
It means hurry up is what it means.
Yeah, it means hurry the F up. So, so basically OUX helps shove as much of it in as possible, but you do need, it's like the pendulum needs to kind of swing somewhere in the middle where we've got some of those pieces, but they're put in a way that can fit in the real world. Basically.
Yeah. It has to be substantive and, you know, and that's the challenge. You have to be substantive, but you have to be substantive really fast.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
It's like, you better get to something that counts now, like yesterday.
Right. Right.
And that's the hard part.
And usually that's like, when can we get to wireframes? When can we get to wireframes? Can we get to wireframes as soon? And sometimes we need to push back on that. We can't immediately jump into sketches and wireframes, which we'll get into. But how do you push back on that? And you can't push back on that to be like, I need 3 more months.
Not
like,
with nothing. No, you got to have something else to offer.
Exactly. It has to have some sort of like that kind of, it's like, ooh, this is interesting. It's making the fuzzier stuff within UX that is often hard to sell, making it more concrete.
Yes.
Concretizing that, which is really, in a meta sense, what object-oriented UX is all about, is concretizing the abstract. But this is, in a macro sense, helping you say, okay, here is some of this like stuff that like we need to understand the domain, for example. Mm-hmm. We need to understand our user. And just saying, oh, I need to understand the user, that's a hard sell.
Totally. It's totally a hard sell because it's like you said, it's abstract. It's airy. All right. Mm-hmm. The reason companies and the reason, you know, folks on the product side are always going, well, when do we get to see, like, let's just get to UI. Let's just get to UI. Whether it's wireframes or actual UI in code, like they want to go there immediately. And the reason they want to go there is because what they really want is some confidence, is some sense of like, okay, we're doing the right thing here. And they need some concrete evidence of that. I think in most traditional UX ways of going about research, you don't have that. So it forces everybody into this uncomfortable waiting game where they don't know what's going to come out the other end. By comparison, if you're starting with an object-oriented approach and you're talking about objects and relationships, again, it's concrete. Everybody gets it. Everybody can see what you're looking at, what you're analyzing. And also, I think you get a sense really fast of why you're looking at those things.
Right.
So some of that fear goes away. Some of that knee-jerk, like, show me something, goes away. And it buys you some very valuable time. To your point, that's kind of how you sit in the middle of these things.
This is so funny. This is like the first time I've actually thought of it exactly this way, is that I mean, an object map, especially if you can train your stakeholders and your business folks and your developers on how to read an object map, takes like 15 minutes to train them how to read it.
Totally.
And then you can show them how does an object map directly inform screens. You can show that transition.
Exactly.
Like, okay, this is going towards screens. I promise it's going towards screens. And you can actually show an example of how like a column in an object map directly informs things like cards and details and lists. And once they see that, they can collaborate on an object map with you and not be so stressed out that like none of this is actually going to like, you know,
that it has no bearing.
That none of it will come to fruition, right? Like a lot of the stuff we do and a lot of the artifacts we create, maybe it does. Maybe it's great and it actually does come to fruition in some way, but our stakeholders can't connect those dots. They're not seeing how those dots are connected. So they're like, no. Like, I need pictures and I need pictures now.
Right.
It's just, we need to give a different type of picture first before we get into that. Does that screen design. So I am so excited about this course, just because everything we just talked about. And also because, as most of you know that are listening, I do have a course now. That course is 22 hours. It is it's the material that you go through in the certification that takes 10 weeks at minimum to go through. So the course,
it's a list.
So the certification, you know, people that like it's 10 to 15 hours a week for 10 weeks straight. The course that we're creating, I'm pretty sure, is like a weekend, maybe two weekends.
Yeah, I think so.
If like you're doing all the exercises and everything, which you should be doing all the exercises, but even like if you really wanted to binge it in a weekend, you could do that. I think it's going to be sitting at around 5 to 6 hours, 4 to 6 hours. But then with the exercises and everything, maybe like 10 hours to really sink your teeth in and complete, which makes it so much more accessible to folks that really just want to get started and potentially want to start. It's Friday. I want to start using this and seeing the benefits on Monday. Like,
completely
you can,
agree.
You can do that. So
much shorter ramp.
Yes, yes. And then maybe if you want to take the masterclass after it, you can dig in deeper and get into things like the requirements round and more on prioritization and deeper actually into sketching. So side note, if you do want to get on the wait list, because this if you're listening now and the course is not out yet, go to oaux.com/offerings/fundamentals. That link will be, of course, in the show notes. So you can go ahead and get in the wait list and you'll be one of the first to know and likely get some pretty good discount too.
More than likely.
You will get a discount. More than likely. Okay, so question for you. About this course. So you've created a course on information architecture. I've taken that course. It's good. It's solid. Yes. Yes.
Tiny.
I learned quite a bit about information. Yeah. What, is it tiny?
To me, it is. It's tip of the iceberg kind of stuff, but it people love it.
Right. I loved it. And it is a great introduction into information architecture. How do you see OUX fitting in with IA? Is it the same thing? Is it different things? Does one inform the other?
Well, here's the thing, okay? And what's really interesting to me, it's funny how things come around, right? When I did that course, if you're going to dip into information architecture, okay, you can take the deep dive, you know, like the Polar Bear book does, and really get into it and sort of go the full route, which is a long, deep, drawn-out course. I took the route of, again, trying to be more practical. How do people apply this? How can I make it make sense to them? How can I get them to see, like, this information structure determines what your model is of how people move through the information that you have and how you organize it, how you prioritize it, et cetera, et cetera. In the same way, I think OOUX is this big chunk of what makes up information architecture. In that, what are we talking about? We're talking about objects and relationships, sure, but we are also talking about relationships between names, between labels, between terms,
mm-hmm.
right? And the relationships between how these pieces of information, in some cases, which sometimes are technically objects, connect to each other.
When you're getting into IA, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. IA is all about understanding how all these pieces work together. Right. And in a way that allows somebody to A, understand what they're looking at, B, make sense of it, understand what goes with what, understand what impacts what, and then set it all up in a way that allows them to sort of move through it in a way that makes sense to them, that leverages their understanding of the world around them and how all these things are connected. So to me, IA is that way. OUX is that way. I think we're coming at it maybe from slightly different places, but the model is very much the same and the goal is very much the same. So to me, they're like this.
Right. Yeah, I see that, like, the way that I see it, and tell me what you think about this, is OUX, in a way, is it is a tool to uncover information architecture projects that need to happen within a project.
Yes.
So, like, I could come up with, when I'm building my object map, and let's say I'm doing it for, let's use our design challenge where we're going to be thinking about parks and trails and points of interest for the National Park Service. So in that sense, with trail, I might say, well, we need to categorize trails by some sort of, let's do another one. This is not an object within our design challenge,
okay.
But funny enough, last week, I didn't tell you this, Joe, before we started recording, so I'm going to tell you now. Guess who I did an OUX workshop for last week?
Who?
The National Park Service.
Are you serious?
I'm not even joking. I was in Smoky Mountains. I was in Gatlinburg. It was at, when they called me, I was like, are you in my head? Like, what's happening here? So we actually did run a workshop. And so one of our objects was wildlife type, which is not an object in our particular design challenge. But when I did it with them, one of the objects was wildlife type with instances like bears, fireflies, bears being a very important one.
Of course.
So we might say, okay, we need a way to categorize wildlife type. Within that, there's a huge information architecture project of how you categorize wildlife within this context. And what else are people searching for? Are they searching for animals? How are people, what are the synonyms? Fireflies and lightning bug, you know, is it the same thing? Is it different things? What are all those labels?
Right.
So we might have that on one little sticky note in an object map and have a big star next to it with like, big IA effort here, right? And that's just one example, right?
Absolutely.
So it almost like it helps not only uncover user interface with the CTA matrix when we're getting into the C of the ORCA process. That's uncovering all the UI that we're going to have to create around user interface when conversations are happening. But then within our attributes, we are uncovering deeper areas for information architecture.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And I see this parallel all the time in what you just mentioned, where you're uncovering that relationship. Like you mentioned, lightning bugs versus fireflies, for example. Okay. This comes up all the time. And I've done some government work, done a lot of enterprise work over the course of my career. It comes up on a consumer side of things as well, where what an organization calls something and what their various constituents call something are completely different. Mm-hmm. And you know when that comes out? It comes out after the thing is out there, has been built, right? And has been invested in for the last 18 months. And now it's so deep and so complex that to change things, we've got a real problem all the way down to the way the database is architected.
Yes.
If that same issue comes out at the very beginning, deeper dive needed here. Now you're playing a very different game and you stand to save a hell of a lot of legwork and unnecessary waste afterward if you call that out up front. So I'm completely, completely in agreement, as you can probably see.
So one example of this is fees versus permits. Was something that we kind of like were playing with last week, where there's like a parking fee, but then there's a permit to like go on a certain trail or do like backcountry camping, which is also a word that end users don't use, front country versus back country.
Yeah.
There's other words used for that, but that's another thing.
Right.
But something between like fees and permits, and they have lotteries as well for certain things to do, where you like pay a dollar to enter the lottery. And then if you get picked, you pay $25 to go do the thing at the certain time to see the thing. So they got fees, permits, lotteries, and also campsite passes. So these are like all things that you pay for. That like, and then they end up in different parts of the site because like, oh, well, a fee is, you know, without really thinking it through, you end up with fees and lotteries being very different things.
Yeah.
Where like potentially these are all just permits. They're all right. permits that you're saying, like, I want to be able to do a thing. One permit requires a lottery. One permit just requires money. So having those conversations early on like, what is this thing? And then, like, then we kind of roll in some UX writing, too, with, like, what is the right word for this? This is all these things sort of intersect, right? Like, this is UX writing. This is information architecture. This is UX as well.
No, completely. And it has everything to do with the people on the receiving end as well. I had a similar experience. I was just in Hawaii a short while back, and we went to one of the parks where there was a mountain where we wanted to go up and see the sunset. There were 6 or 7 different flavors of same kind of thing. Permits, fees, and I literally, for a half hour, I couldn't figure out which one I was supposed to buy.
Right.
Same kind of reason, because the nomenclature was all over the place, you know, and it didn't do a very good job of differentiating between them. So you're left with, okay, do I buy one of everything? Like, what do I do here?
Right. Yes. And sometimes you do need multiple ones to, like, do a thing. You need, like, a pass.
See, in one case, we did.
On this trail.
Right.
And then from the pass. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, do I need this pass? I pay the parking fee and then I get the pass to do the thing. And then I need a permit for camping.
Yep. I had to make a phone call to find out.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is exactly what they're trying to prevent. CQ calling or waltzing into the visitor center and being like, hi, I'm here.
By the way,
can you help me plan my next 3 days, please?
Yeah, exactly.
And the park ranger's like, I have 17 other things to do. Cool. So this brings us more to process, which we've been dancing around. Process and, like, big process. Process with a capital P and process with a little P. We can't not talk about agile and sprints.
Really?
And process. Yeah. We got to talk
about it. I'm sorry.
We got to talk about it just a little bit. And this is, like, front of mind for me because OAUX got recently called out in a Medium article that is circulating around.
I saw that.
About how these prescriptive UX processes, and I like how OAUX got, like, just mentioned. Like, everybody knows what OAUX is.
It shouldn't have been.
Well, I'm flattered in a way. I'm flattered in a way that it got mentioned as if everybody knows what OAUX is, which is not true yet. It's not true yet. So, but it also got mentioned in the same breath as design systems, which I'm also flattered by. I like being, you know, okay, design systems and OAUX. But basically this idea that these are these over-prescriptive processes. I mean, and you have your thoughts on Agile, which we can get into. But the thing that I, you know, I'm curious about, genuinely curious about, is you have talked about the problem with UX theater and, like, too much like these, like, heavy upfront processes that don't make sense in the real
world. Right.
And here you are endorsing
a process
that happens to be in its little picture perfect way, 15 steps, step 13 being sketching. So you don't even get to sketching until step 13. Like, what gives?
Yeah, Mr. I don't give a shit about process. Here's the thing. Okay.
Yeah.
I say this all the time. And I read that article and I agreed with the majority of it.
And before you get in, let me do the quote. So for those that have not read the article, I'm going to link. It's this proliferate, pronouncing words. This proliferate.
That word. I don't even know what the word is.
This proliferation.
Yeah.
This proliferation of overly prescriptive approaches reliant on component libraries like design systems, OUX, etc., has led to mass avoidance of meaningful work.
See, but that's where he got it wrong, okay? Reliance on component libraries. I know where he's going, and I know what he means. And I agreed with just about every word of that article, except for that part. I totally understand what he's getting at. There are any number of overly prescriptive processes. Design systems in particular, design libraries, have been used as a crutch, okay? If we have a library and we have a bunch of existing patterns, all we have to do is plug and play. We don't have to use our brains anymore. We don't have to think about the context of the situation, the context of the user, and what they do or don't understand. And in issues like information architecture, right? Mm-hmm. Issues like labeling, that absolves us from thinking, and which is kind of his overall point. And I'm there 100%. You know that.
Right.
I have a problem with processes that are fixed in stone, that if you don't do it this way, it's not the right way. Like, that's not the right way to do UX. That's not the right way to do. I think that is bullshit. Life is too, life and work and companies and projects and products, everything is much too flexible. There are too many external factors that determine how things go and how often they go off the rails or go sideways. Executive pressure, politics, any number of things, right? I'm not against processes. I'm not against having tools in your arsenal. I'm not even against simple yet flexible prescriptions. So to me, there's every part of OUX to me has the potential to meet you where you are. Instead of saying you must be at this point and you must do, you know, this thing first and then this thing and this thing and this thing, I think that every part of OUX is flexible enough to sort of take into account the reality of the situation, whatever it may be. It doesn't force this perfect world situation where I have this much time, I have this much budget, I have these people in the room, I have access to these users, I have, right? It doesn't presume any of that, in my opinion. It meets you where you are and says, here's a set of tools that you can use no matter what you're working on, no matter how much time you have, no matter what approval you do or don't have to do certain kinds of work. And you can run this no matter who you are, where you are, who you work with, what company you work for. It doesn't matter. It applies all the time. And I think all those other things, some of the things that he's talking about, many parts of the lean and agile process, yeah, that's the gospel. It must be Scrum. It must be whatever, none of those things, they should be, but they're not flexible enough to do the same thing because of the way they're practiced. If you go back to the Agile Manifesto, it's a beautiful document. The origins of extreme programming were in certainly everybody's hearts and heads were in the right place. That got turned into a process trademark, okay, that we must follow by the letter dogmatically, even though it's kicking our ass every day of the week.
Right.
But we got to keep doing it. This is not that at all.
Right. Right. Yes. 100%. And actually, so we had a OUX happy hour last week with Danny Norton. Shout out to Danny and her colleague, Liza Richardson. And they are at Athena Healthcare using OUX for electronic healthcare records. Incredibly complicated, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
And their talk, like one of the main theses of their talk was like, OUX is helping us a lot, but we had to break it. We had to basically like we could not treat it as this prescriptive, like boot camp type style of
correct.
Like, then you do this, and then you do this, then you do this, and you do this.
That's right.
We had to take it and say, how is this going to fit for the complexity that we are dealing with now? So it's like, this, I feel like it's like a learn some rules so that you can then play with them and remix them and break them and take them to your situation.
Yes.
And because it's, I mean, and I have that idealized process, but it is like, it's the Plato's idea horse, right? It's not a real horse, right?
Right. But it has to be to your credit. Okay. To your credit. It has to be built and architected in such a way that it allows that kind of flexibility. You can't do that with everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Most things don't hold up well to situations where the parameters aren't what they ideally should be. And
right.
I think OUX does.
Okay, so to recap this ORCA process, we've got our pillars, which is objects, relationships, calls to action, and attributes, okay? Which will usually go in the order of ORCA, but you can definitely mix things around. You might start with objects and you might go to C, and then you might go to R, or you might really like, and then you go to attributes. You can definitely pop around, but those are these main pillars. Mm-hmm. And then we also have rounds of the ORCA process. So that first round being discovery, that likely second round being requirements, and then prioritization and then representation. Then once we get to representation, that is step 13, all right? That is in this archetypical process, right? So we're doing quite a bit of work before we get to that sketching.
Mm-hmm.
Once we finally do get to sketching, we're not even looking at an empty whiteboard, okay? We've got templates.
No.
We've got OUX-style templates to help you take the object map and then zhuzh that object map into cards and details and list as well. And we can take all of the stuff that we've done, all the work that we've done in the object map, and just directly transition it into these kind of, this kind of foundational building blocks of what will become the screens. Mm-hmm. So my question for you, Joe, about this kind of sketching, like doing all of the structural work and then getting into sketching and even having templates for our sketching, is this taking the creativity out of sketching, out of design?
I'm sure you'd find people that would argue, yes, I'm not one of them. I firmly believe, and I learned this all the way back in design school. It's been true my entire career. I think that constraints and guardrails, okay, are your best friend. Context is your best friend. You cannot possibly hope to design something that is appropriate, that's relevant, that solves the problem at hand, that is meaningful not only to the people on the receiving end of whatever you're designing and building, but you know, to the business that's sponsoring all that activity as well. I don't think you have a hope of approaching that appropriateness or relevance if you don't have sort of good guardrails and constraints around that process. So in other words, I think those things actually enhance your ability to be creative and come up with good solutions and think outside the normal atypical solutions. Just by nature, you're sort of shown the door, like the door is here, okay?
Right.
You have to walk through this before you can accomplish anything else. That's necessary focus.
And I remember in WACC when I was in school for industrial design, when we had a project where we had to design a chair, and it could be any chair. Mm-hmm. And I remember being so kind of like, well, who is this chair for?
That's a terrible brief. It was a terrible
assignment because it was so hard to actually, my creativity. So I actually, on this project, created a constraint for myself that my chair needed to be able to be flat packed, like IKEA style.
There you go.
And that was the only constraint that I created, but I was like, oh, and then I gave myself a budget because they didn't give us budgets either. So some people were spending like $700 on their chair design. And I was like, I actually in college was on quite a budget. So I gave myself $30 and it had to be flat packed. This is back when plywood was much cheaper.
I was going to say wood was probably a lot cheaper then.
Yeah. Yeah. Plywood was not like whatever it is now, $40 a sheet or something that. But I gave myself $30 at Home Depot. And so once I had those constraints, my creativity just soared.
Exactly right. And that's the difference between, you know, fine art. If you're creating something that is based on self-expression, right? And just trying to come up with something that is, I don't know, bigger than life, outside all normal boundaries. That makes all the sense in the world. But when you're talking about creating software, you're creating a product of any kind, even if it's a physical product to your chair example, the fact is the world around you has constraints. There are built-in rules and limitations that you sort of have to be aware of, especially if you're going to try to push those things to their ultimate boundary. You have to know where that line is in order to even approach it, and possibly in some cases in order to break it, because you have to know what all the dependencies are that get touched as a result of your doing that. So yeah, I don't buy the it hampers creativity argument at all.
And so in a way, I mean, I could look at, let's say I need to design the trail detail page. Mm-hmm. Like I could look at a blank piece of paper to design a trail detail page. And I'm looking at that blank piece of paper.
You're going to be looking at it for a while.
Or now I start saying, okay, as I start making up a bunch of attributes, right? I'm like, oh, there's going to be level of difficulty on there. And like, but I haven't actually talked to the team about, do we have that data? Do we want to even actually, one thing I learned about level of difficulty when I was working with the National Park Service folks was that this is something that's so relative, it's become meaningless. And that things like elevation and length and terrain. So terrain is actually a better qualifier than level of difficulty. Like to say that like, you're going to have to do some bouldering here.
Yeah. So if you don't know that, you're missing necessary context mm-hmm. as a user to make a decision.
So if I have that object map and I've got, here's all the attributes that I need to put on this page, in a way, like, I have to be more creative. I have to, like, because I have those constraints. Like, how am I gonna communicate all this stuff? It's more, you're getting more to being creative about the how, because you've already defined the what. You don't need, you're, instead of multitasking, and while you're trying to figure out the how, you're also trying to figure out the what, which, to be honest, the what needs to be done so collaboratively with the business, like, you don't want to be that creative around it. I mean, I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but you don't want to be pulling things out of thin air.
No, you're going to waste a lot of time exploring a lot of directions that aren't ever going to work for any number of reasons.
So, on to flip it around, are there any scenarios where you do want that kind of blank canvas thinking?
I think there can be, but again, it's difficult. I think at the very early onset of a process, I think we're probably backing up all the way to more the beginning when you're starting, when you simply don't have that information, right? So you are sort of staring at a wide open field in any number of ways. But I think I honestly think it's very tough in terms of designing a product, because again, we're talking about context, relevance, appropriateness, and things like that. I think it's very difficult to not have some of that information, you know, to some reasonable degree. I don't know that you can ever start with a totally blank canvas.
Right. When I think back to like sketching before OAUX, like what did that look like to me? And it really was like, before I'd done any object mapping, like that was where the beginning of the process was, right? Like, mm-hmm. That's where a lot of people begin their UX process. They've got a bunch of research. They read through the research. They kind of like, okay, or the lack thereof research. Like, just try to understand the user as much as possible and the needs.
Right.
Look at an existing screen, and then you start sketching. That's where often the process will start. And what I would do often is I would start with a main flow. I would come up with a main flow and be like,
right,
build my itinerary, or find the trail that's right for me.
Yep, same.
And so I'll start designing these screens. And what's happening is I'm designing these, I'm like, okay, well, maybe the first thing you maybe get asked a series of questions. So it's like a little bit like a wizard or something like that. So I might have like the wizard design that I mm-hmm. on my blank whiteboard, right? Okay, so like you say like, do you have kids with you, or do you how long do you want to hike for, how much time
right.
do you have through. and then it comes, and then it's like, here's the trail for you to do today. And I'm designing that flow, but what I'm doing is I'm making all these assumptions about what data we actually have.
Yes.
I'm making assumptions that we know which trails are good for kids and which trails are not good for kids.
Yes.
I'm making assumptions around knowing the terrain for each of those trails. I'm making all of these assumptions, and I'm doing, again, that multitasking of, like, I am figuring out a data model while I'm figuring out a flow, which is going to often result in rework. And then I'm giving it to the business
right.
or to the developers and they have to look at it, and they might be saying – they have to kind of reverse engineer it. So you might have – one business stakeholder that sees it like, that looks really cool, and they just assume that it can be done, right? Even though they're not thinking about the data.
Yeah,
not trying to reel it back. And then it gets to the developer, and the developer's like, we can't build this. Like, this doesn't make any sense.
Yep.
So, but if you do have that data already, like, we very well might design a flow like that for finding a trail. But once I have that object map first, I can now play, and I can say, what is the best way right. for somebody to find a trail or build their own itinerary? Because I know what a trail is, and I know what an itinerary is, and I know how they relate to each other, and I know that an itinerary has multiple trails in it, potentially. So I understand the relationship, and I understand the structure, and now I can actually play on that blank sheet of paper with that information backing me up.
Completely agree. Like I said, the only thing that happens when you're completely blank is that you fill that space with your own thoughts, you know, which is sometimes that has value if you can get past that and then say, okay, how do I find the things that I don't know? How do I figure out what my blind spots are? How do I figure out what I'm missing here? But that, let's face it, that's difficult. All right. It's especially difficult for one person to do in isolation. And a lot of people working in this field are teams of one. You know, I've met many. So again, all the more reason to start with something that can actually inform what you're doing in a really substantive, contextual way.
One other one that I just thought of, for blank. It's not like you never want that fully blank piece of paper, but
no.
Even okay, so before we get to our templatized cards and detail sketches that are informed by the object map, right? Mm-hmm. There could be other sketching in the form of like system modeling / entity relationship diagramming, or like other diagrams. Like there's so many diagrams within the OUX process that are really solid.
Yes.
But sometimes there's all these other diagramming methodologies that like sometimes it's like some sort of like circle like Venn diagrammy circle thing.
Yeah. Boxes and arrows,
right? You're just trying to figure out how all these concepts sit within each other, right? Yeah. So it's again like going back to that, like learn all these tools or / rules so that then you can mash them together and remix them for a particular situation, and you might create some sort of like Venn diagram matrix thing.
Totally.
That's what you need.
I spent 3 days this week with a client. This past week, doing the exact same thing. Okay, it was 3 days, and we covered a lot of ground all over the place because this was a really convoluted, complicated set of things. I don't know how to describe it without giving too much away, but it required an awful lot of sketching. Okay, I had like 13. It wasn't a whiteboard because it was virtual, but I had 13 pages of boxes, arrows, and circles, and all sorts of things. Just trying to map. To your point, these relationships, and in some cases objects, and in some cases other things, just to try and get our arms around, okay, what is this? Forget about the interface, forget about the interaction, forget about all this stuff right now. What are these things? How much of it is there? How is it related? How much of it do we have to touch and have to deal with? How much can wait till later? It was all those kinds of things that you're talking about. Absolutely.
Right. And yeah, so I think you just answered this, but just to reiterate, so of those 13 pages, how much UI?
None.
Was sketched. None. Zero.
None.
So that is so it's like if you think about sketching this process, there's like diagramming, which is like for me is often like system model, objects, relationships. But mm-hmm. then I'm sometimes bringing in other stuff too.
Right.
Like even like teams.
Totally.
Or,
yeah. Like they creep in there.
They creep in there. Right. So like I so many diagrams. It is a combination of diagramming techniques that I'm using all in one diagram. And that is so fun. And it does feel like I need a blank piece of paper. I can't get a template. Nobody's going to make a template for me to be able to do that. I just need to know what a matrix is, what a Venn diagram is, what like a bubble diagram is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I need as many diagramming methods as possible. Abby Covert has a new book on my list.
I saw
about
that.
This.
I saw that.
So Abby Covert is a really good person
She's
to go
awesome.
To
awesome.
For like lots of different diagramming methodologies. And then OUX, this way of thinking, can support that, but you're going to have to bring it all together. So that's like early on. Then you do your object mapping just to bring this all together. Object mapping that can help you now get cards and details and even help you out with those lists and landing pages too, which are like these like nice, big, chunky building blocks, right?
Yeah, clarity.
Yes. And so we're turning the corner into layout, a little bit of layout, like all, you know, a little bit of UI involved a bit. And then from there, you might have more blank canvas thinking, quote unquote, blank canvas thinking on the stuff behind those CTAs. How does somebody flow through something? What are even like, you know, what is the cool animation that's going to happen? You might do sketching around an animation or a new UI pattern that you really want to introduce into your design system because your design system doesn't have exactly what you need.
Yep.
So you've looked at your design system and you're like, okay, what can I pull? What's already existing? Oh, we're doing something new here. And that's where you can really like focus all your creativity
Absolutely.
On the new thing that you have to make, the innovation.
Absolutely. I can't tell you how many times I've walked into a client situation and they say, well, we have the screens up. We have the UI that we have right now. Or we have the current build or whatever. And I'm like, that's great. Park it over there. Don't want to see it. Uninterested because it's never going to, but I know that by the time we're through the first couple of days, none of that is going to hold water. I mean, I know that already. And that's partly experience, but it's also because of all the things you just discussed and how all that feeds into what should go into an interface, what should go into interaction sequences, because it's usually not there when teams are in isolation building this stuff.
So one more thing that I do want to say about sketching, and when anybody's learning the OUX process and they're learning about kind of how to pause on that UI sketching, mm-hmm. I just want to say that it's hard. This yes. is very, very difficult for folks that have been basically so used to jumping into sketching.
Yes.
When I'm running my OUX workshops in person and I'm seeing people working on an object map, I will often, I joke that I go around with my ruler to like slap people's hands when I see them doing little UI sketches so that they can build their object
map.
Not now. Stop. So it is really tough. It requires some retraining.
Yes.
So I would just encourage everybody to give it a go, really try to restrain yourselves. Try to start thinking in this new visual language, which is the object map, right? Think in this visual language so that, because you can move that stuff around so much more lightly and yes. I would say leanly, agilely, because it's lower fidelity, right? So it's lower fidelity, but like high information fidelity, but low visual fidelity. So try your best to retrain yourself, to put the pencil down, try to think in this a different visual language, more diagrammatically, until you really get clear on what those objects are, what their relationships are, and what those objects are actually made of.
I think that'll be an eye-opening moment for most people as well. I think if you do things in that order and you do restrain yourself, I think what you're going to find is by the time you do get to actual UI work, your brain is going to see just how much you now have at your disposal to work with versus the way you used to do it before. I really think most people are going to see a massive difference and think, oh, wow, this is so much better. It is so much easier to work like this. And I really do think it's going to be a light bulb moment for people, but you have to repress that initial urge to go there, you know, and just stick with the object mapping first.
100%. In the certification program, when people finally get to sketching, there's so many light bulb moments that go off and saying, wow, this is so much easier. I'm doing so much less rework. These screens are just designing themselves almost.
Yeah, you know and what then, you're designing.
You know what and you're why. Designing. And then you can focus so much more on like, what about this like cool kind of progressive disclosure thing that we can do here? Yeah. Or you can kind of play a little bit more with that UI or like think about like maybe an animation that might go there and adding that delight and seeing how you can pull the brand voice in, things like that. You can kind of free your mind up for yes. doing those things.
Yes, absolutely.
So OUX sketching for the win.
Amen.
So hopefully you are convinced of that all the things that you should do before you get into sketching UI specific sketching.
Yep.
So you're all jazzed about OUX. You're ready to bring it to your organization. And what kind of pushback, Joe, what kind of pushback, knowing what you know about OUX and knowing what you know about working in all the organizations that you have been worked through in your decades of experience, what do you think is going to happen when the person that is all excited about this and it says, no, I can't start sketching yet. I got to do these other things first because I don't really understand what I'm sketching.
Yep.
What is going to happen?
It's going to be a little uncomfortable at first. A lot of people are automatically, okay, anytime you go to somebody with a process, say, no, we're going to do it. I want to do something this way. All sorts of alarm bells go off in that person's head, depending on what role they have, right? For managers, for executive types, for example, they hear time, money. It's going to take too long. It's going to slow everybody down. Their development teams will be like, oh, it's going to slow us down. And everybody sort of has this initial resistance to like, not another thing, which I understand because everybody's got their heads down and they've got all they can deal with, right, in any given moment. The key to that is, to me, this is no different than trying to get anything else through, in that you've got to bring people into this by helping them see how it benefits them. Okay. They have to know from word go how this makes things better, faster, more efficient, less waste, less rework. You want to talk to development teams? Talk to them about rework. Talk to them about how many times they're surprised by what they're getting from design. Talk to design about how many times they're getting surprised by what dev built. Talk to managers about how many times they feel like, didn't we solve this already? Why are we still talking about it? Or what about all this unexpected stuff that just came up for the umpteenth time as we're 6 weeks into development? Mm-hmm. Any number of things. But you can't, it's like anything else, you can't lead with, here's this other thing that I'm asking everybody to be involved in now. Doesn't work like that. You got to bring everybody into the process, but you got to bring them into the process by starting with the places where this eliminates irritation and frustration and extra work and extra lifting for them, which it absolutely does. So you're going to get an immediate like, oh no, not another thing.
I've heard like, oh, this seems like big design up front. Like this is like too much before we get into, yeah. And you know, I get it. Like we, our industry got so burned by Waterfall and, you know, spending 18 months on something that is going to go get burned onto a CD-ROM and then get shipped off to, you know,
totally
3 million people or something like that. And then it just doesn't meet the needs. Like that sucked. Like that was,
yes,
that was not good. And, but this is like, we also don't want no design up front, which is often like, you know, we, the again, like the pendulum needs to somehow swing back a little bit.
Yeah. So there's some give and take that has to happen there. I mean, you can't have no design up front. Okay. You can't. Every agile or lean team I've ever worked with sooner or later comes to grips with the fact that you have to do a certain amount of work up front before you start committing things to code. You have to, all right? There's no getting around that. Pay now, pay later. Doesn't matter. You're going to pay. So yeah. To your point, absolutely.
And often that design, though, does happen. I mean, it's sketching. It goes that's its design, basically. They might be low fidelity sketches, but that's what we think design is. It's just the sketching or maybe the prototyping. And what OAUX is saying is like, no, there's a little bit more to design than just sketching screens.
Right.
We really need to think through how these, what are the pieces and how do all the pieces fit together? And I think often also that design is very feature by feature. So it's like, we're going to think about design up front a little bit, you know, we're going to be lean and we're going to think about design up front. And it's going to be just for this page or just for this section of this page.
Yeah, small component.
Small components.
Small
chunks.
We're
not thinking about how it fits into the wider ecosystem. So I guess I would ask you for your advice, because we know that there's going to be pushback. There's a lot of things that other things that might come up too. What one of them being, oh, object-oriented UX, like, is that user-centered or not? And there's answers to all of these because people think, oh, object-oriented programming, like, is object-oriented? And, you know, you kind of have to tell those stories of like, well, actually, our brains are pretty object-oriented.
It's completely user-centered.
It's so user-centered. It's so user-centered. So, like, there are going to be, like change is hard, basically. You're going to have to change hearts and minds and institutionalize processes. What do you say for somebody who is learning this and might be a junior mid-level UX designer? They don't have a seat at the table. And maybe they're a little bit of an introvert. You know, for me, I love being a thorn in people's side. I don't love it, but I don't mind it. Joe's raising his hand here. So yeah, like being kind of a disruptor. Like I enjoy being a disruptor. I'm okay with that. For the folks, that's not everybody though.
Sure.
Right? That is definitely not everybody.
Sure.
So for and in the course, we are going to talk about some ways to get started and ways to kind of combat this, to basically start getting OOUX going within your organization. But from a mindset perspective, what kind of advice do you have for somebody who might be a bit more introverted, who might not feel as comfortable going and being being that disruptor?
Yeah. I think a big part of this is I think that it's all lightweight enough, strangely as that may sound. that you don't necessarily have to get every single person in the organization on board with what you're doing. I think if you have 8 hours in a day, how you spend it is entirely up to you. And this is something that I talk to individuals on teams about all the time. And they say, well, no one's ever going to agree with this way of working. And my question back to them is always, does that matter? If you're doing the work by yourself, essentially, which a lot of these folks are, they really are working in some degree of isolation, unfortunately. So can you still go through these exercises yourself, even if no one will play in your sandbox with you? Yes. Does it still hold value? Yes. Will it still get you to better solutions that also impact those folks' lives and workloads and make their jobs easier and more efficient and get you more in sync with what they're doing? Yes. Okay. So there doesn't have to be any official sanction of we're doing OOUX now. Mm-hmm. You incorporate it into what you're doing, period. Whether anybody does or does not go along with you, I don't want to say it's irrelevant. It certainly helps if they are, but they don't have to be.
100%. I love that you said that because I say like you shouldn't need permission. Like,
no,
don't
never.
Ask for permission.
You're asking to be told
understand.
No.
Yeah, I know. Well, you shouldn't have to ask for permission to understand something, to understand what you're designing.
Right.
And if this is a tool, at the end of the day, this is a tool for understanding, for getting clarity, understanding what the hell you're actually designing.
That's right.
And you should not have to ask for permission. So I agree wholeheartedly. If you do get pushback, like, or if you just don't feel like even like you're not that salesperson type, to just start using it and see how it works within your own process.
Yes.
And I've even suggested before, I would like your thoughts on this, of using a little bit of reverse psychology and like, just like you've created your little object map or huge object map maybe, mm-hmm. and you're just using it to identify questions, and maybe you get the right people. You're like, okay, I have some questions about this. I've identified some questions, and you just screen share or put your object map up on the screen as like an outline for your questions.
Yes.
So you're like, okay, I have a question. And then maybe you click on it and you have the question, and then have people be like, what is this diagram thing that you have with all these pretty colors? And say something like, oh, this is an object map. It's just a tool that I'm using to like make sure I understand all the pieces and all their components. It's nothing you need to worry about.
Right. This is how I think through stuff.
This is just how I think through stuff. If you do want to learn more, I would love to, you know, we can set up 30 minutes or something and I can talk you through. It's like actually a really pretty cool tool.
Yep. Totally, yeah. totally on board with that.
Just be casual about it. It doesn't have to be this like big, okay, now we are becoming an OOUX design team. Like it doesn't have to be like that.
Yeah. Nothing needs to be officially sanctioned.
Right. Okay, Joe. So we're going to be covering quite a bit in this course. We just touched on some of these tiny subjects around the process and sketching and how to push back against pushback. Mm-hmm. I know we talked about what you're most excited about, but like, what is the main thing that you want people to take away from this course that we're creating together?
I think the main thing for me is I want everybody to see what I really think everybody's going to be jazzed about and what I think is going to make the most impact is I want them to see how, I can't think of the term, how demystifying, uncomplicating, decomplexifying, I'm trying to think of the right word.
Demystifying is good.
You know, I think that OUX in general, especially once you start exercising some of these muscles and doing these things, make it really clear just how much of a straight line there is between starting with an object-oriented approach and what you wind up with on the screen. And I also think that you see how quickly you get to, again, relevant, context-specific, appropriate solutions as a result. And I also think that once you start thinking and working that way, you're going to feel like, I don't know how I ever did this any other way. and that's a wonder. That's a really cool thing when it happens. So I kind of am wanting to wait and see the light bulbs, you know, go off over people's heads once they start doing this.
And I'm sure they will. I'm super excited to launch this with you and
Same.
Everybody out there. Happy OUXing. I hope you sign up for us. I hope you sign up for the wait list. OUX.com/offerings/something else.
Right.
Gonna have to edit that ending. And oh my God, I need to plug in my computer.
Before it dies.
And my computer did die. That link is OUX.com/offerings/fundamentals. That's OUX.com/offerings/fundamentals. That, of course, will be in the show notes. I really hope to see you in the course.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!